The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting here on KPCG and the live stream at our websites, kpcg.fm and the trumpet.com website. On Friday's show, we had that stream go up on the YouTube channel as well. I think there were some, we didn't even really advertise it, but there were something like 185 to 190 views while the show was going on. And Richard tells me this morning that even though it's a small group, it came from 24 countries around the world. So a scattered bunch, that's for sure. And I guess the program has since remained on YouTube, and we've had something like 900 views, people that have come along and watched it later. So it looks like a good way to pick up a few hundred extra people to listen to or to watch the program. And that is something that we're going to try to do more often. We still are just trying to work out some of the bugs and to make sure it's just more reliable each week before we try to promote it more on Twitter and other social media sites. In any event, some good results for doing it on a day when we really didn't even advertise it. Well, on today's show, we've got a lot to get to. I'll continue with our study that we left off with on Friday's show, the Book of Origins, going through some of those verses, those foundational verses in the very first chapter of the book of Genesis, the Book of Origins, and just help us to hopefully come to understand better the time lapse that is there between verses 1 and 2 and what's really taking place there in the rest of the chapter, chapter 1 of the book of Genesis. So we'll have more on that on today's show in the second segment. Before I get into some of the news from the weekend, I might just mention, too, that the program that was posted from my father's Key of David's was The Meaning of Passover. It was a repeat, but certainly meet in due season. If you didn't see that, you can get to that, as well as his latest article at the trumpet.com website. And speaking of Passover, you have The Meaning of Passover, the one that he had reposted this past weekend. And then we'll be posting from this end of the Atlantic, we'll be posting a program this Friday on the fight for Passover. And we'll probably be playing that audio sometime later this week as well. So as I say, lots of meat in due season. Well, over the weekend, Barack Obama met with the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel. And this relationship, he's out of office now, of course, but this relationship, this love affair, as we've called it often, we were writing about this back in 2009 when he first came into office. We were writing about it in 2013. I think I have an article here from Brad McDonald that goes into this love affair that many nations in the world are having with Germany. And then Richard Palmer and I, we wrote about it more recently in a 2016 piece. But here is Barack Obama visiting Germany. He has a couple of, I guess, town hall kinds of discussions. But then this mysterious behind-closed-doors meeting with Chancellor Merkel, it makes you wonder, well, what would the reaction be? It didn't even really get that much coverage. But imagine 2 years from now, Elizabeth Warren, she becomes president, and Donald Trump, who's no longer president, goes and meets with, pick your world leader, and they meet behind closed doors. Can you imagine the kind of coverage, the kind of speculation? What happened? What did they discuss? We know both of them really don't get along with Donald Trump, certainly not Barack Obama. But it hasn't been the smoothest relationship between Merkel and Mr. Trump either. Why aren't there more journalists who are curious at least curious. What happened? What was said? The New York Times. Well, before I get to that, let me just give you a snippet from the New Zealand Herald talking about how Merkel hosted the former president and how that he stands in stark contrast to the previous meetings that she's had with the current occupant of the White House. That would be Donald Trump. The Herald says images of Merkel and Obama, the get-together, show them embracing and smiling while inside the meeting that lasted more than an hour. Obama at one point pats Merkel on the back. And, of course, previous to this, I think Barack Obama said that she was one of his favorite partners during his time in office while he was president. And, of course, the love for Obama in return, that was there from the beginning, even before he was voted in as president. Who can forget his speech in Berlin back in 2008? 200-some-odd thousand people that turned out for that one. Just welcoming him in with open arms, and then soon after he's in office, early on in 2009, his administration made its first foreign policy statement at that Munich Global Security Conference. That's back in February of 2009. The New York Times over the weekend, it said that this most recent trip, how that Barack Obama evokes nostalgia in Germany. He evokes nostalgia. If only we could still have Barack Obama as president, many commentators are saying in Germany this weekend. Now, as I say, we've covered this at length at thetrumpet.com. For years, the 2016 piece, it says, this is from The Trumpet, the European Union is one of the greatest political and economic achievements of modern times. That's what Barack Obama, then President Obama, said. He just loved the European Union. And remember, toward the end of his presidency, Britain was considering whether to leave the European Union, and Obama was there threatening the UK. Well, if you leave, you might have to go to the back of the queue. You might have to get to the back of the line in trade. We love the European Union. We love everything about it. He was more in love with the European Union than some of the bureaucrats in Brussels are. The ones in the European Union. He's very much pro-EU, the former president. The New York Times says, in Germany, Mr. Trump's presidency is increasingly seen as a challenge to America's commitment to Europe. Of course, Mr. Trump would argue that point. It's not a challenge. He's very much for Europe as well. It's just in a very different way. Very different way. Mr. Trump's presidency is increasingly seen as a challenge to America's commitment to Europe and the values that underpin the Western alliance. And then it just notes this in passing, which it should be a shocking statement. We've noted this before. It still is amazing to just read it in black and white, no matter the publication. It says 3 times more Germans trust Vladimir Putin of Russia and President Xi Jinping of China to do the right thing than Mr. Trump, according to a survey by Pew Research Center. That's from last September. 3 times as many Germans. They trust Putin and Xi to do the right thing, more so than Donald Trump. No wonder they embraced. No wonder she welcomed him to Berlin with open arms. And then they scurried off into the privacy of their own room where they could, build up the current administration of the United States? Not hardly. The Trumpet article we had in 2013, this was by Brad McDonald, it says, Germany has a long history with tyranny, with powerful men and regimes amassing power, then abusing it with unspeakable cruelty and horror. That's just been the history. We've got to be honest. That has been the history. And President Obama was talking about the relative peace that we've seen in Europe for the past 70-odd years. But how was that peace maintained? How was it maintained? Well, you'd have to look at the United States and NATO. But that history is being revised even as we speak. Mr. McDonald said this, it's been nearly 70 years since World War II ended and 24 years since the Berlin Wall fell. Today, Germany and the German people are respected, admired, and very often envied by peoples and nations the world over. Much of this is deserved, too. He talks about the many trips he's made to Germany and the qualities of character that the German people have. And I don't think he gets into as much what my father's talked about so often, about what God will do with that nation, with the people of Germany, the ancient Assyrian people, once the kingdom of God is set up and established on this earth. But that hasn't happened yet, and we have to learn from history lest it repeat itself. Mr. McDonald was writing this article, by the way, in large part because of a speech that Barack Obama had given in 2013. This was a follow-up to his speech as a candidate in 2008. The 2013 speech, that was the one that he gave on that hot summer day out in front of the Brandenburg Gate. And he had this to say. We'll start with clip 5.
But I come here today, Berlin, to say complacency is not the character of great nations. Today's threats are not as stark as they were half a century ago. But the struggle for freedom and security and human dignity, that struggle goes on. And I've come here to this city of hope because the tests of our time demand the same fighting spirit that defined Berlin a half century ago.
That's then President Barack Obama, nearly 6 years ago, urging Germany not to be complacent, but to step up. To step up. Look, the threats aren't as great as they used to be. And so you've got to dig deep. You've got to find that fighting spirit, Germany. You've got to take the lead. Listen. Listen, the EU is an awesome organization here. And Germany, you've got to take the lead. Stop being complacent. Stop worrying about your history. This was the message that Germany got from the United States from 2009 to 2016. No wonder. No wonder there's so much love for former President Barack Obama. No wonder he's meeting behind closed doors with Chancellor Merkel. One more clip from that 2013 speech, clip 6.
I say all this here in the heart of Europe because our shared past shows that none of these challenges can be met unless we see ourselves as part of something bigger than our own experience. Our alliance is the foundation of global security. Our trade and our commerce is the engine of our global economy. Our values call upon us to care about the lives of people we will never meet when Europe and America lead with our hopes instead of our fears. We do things that no other nations can do. No other nations will do.
Europe and America, he kept saying. And a point that Brad McDonald brought out in his 2013 speech, sorry, his 2013 article, is that 30 years earlier, this speech would have been given in Chicago or London or St. Louis or any of the famous big cities in the United States and Britain. But that was in Berlin. That was where Obama was talking about, we're citizens not of America and Germany, but But citizens of the world, pro-world, pro-European Union, we're part of something bigger than our own experience, he said. But he wasn't saying it about America and Great Britain. He wasn't preaching in front of Buckingham Palace. He wasn't preaching in front of some of the monuments in Washington, D.C. This was in Berlin. Now, the hoopla and euphoria, it wasn't quite as pronounced in 2013 as it was in 2008. But still, he returns to a much smaller gathering this past weekend, and here come the press. Oh, they're giddy. If only we still had President Obama. And then there he is, emerging from his private meeting with Angela Merkel. And they're seen embracing. He had a speech in the lead up to this private meeting. I believe this was Friday evening, and it was in a town hall kind of environment. Listen to what he says about Europe in this first clip, clip one.
Europe in 2019, in some ways, has achieved the pinnacle of human well-being.
Just a strange statement for an American president, even a former president, to be making a statement he made in Germany. Europe in 2019 has achieved the pinnacle of human well-being. This is practically a utopia. What we're seeing in Europe today, never mind the rise of nationalism or the yellow vest protests in France or just anti-Semitism sweeping across the continent or its own problems with immigration, mass immigration. Here is Barack Obama, like he did when he was president, talking about how tranquil and peaceful and loving the world is. A little messy here and there, but for the most part, a sea of tranquility. It's amazing, really, that he makes this statement right as our new Trumpet magazine's coming out, the one with truth on the issue, or the front cover. Richard Palmer reminded me of this morning in our scrum meeting. He said that, really, when you look at the history of Europe, there are those who, just like Barack Obama did over the weekend, who want to say that everything has just been just splendid. Centuries on end. As Richard writes in his piece, hand in hand with this rosy view of Europe's future is a rosy picture of Europe's past. The Greeks invented democracy, we tell ourselves. Rome invented the rule of law. The Roman Empire ushered in peace, prosperity, and progress. Life was good until Rome fell. And then we reached the Dark Ages, a time of violence and barbarity. Human progress stopped, Richard writes. The world was only illuminated for brief periods when European rulers attempted to resurrect the Roman Empire. Then came the Enlightenment. Free thinkers across Europe invented freedom as we know it today. Britain developed those ideas. America put them into practice with a radical new government based on these ideals. He says, finally, with that perspective on the past, it seems obvious that a united, self-confident Europe built on historical values would be a force for good in the world. It's just obvious. The EU, Germany, these are forces for good. Donald Trump's a force for evil. So we need you, Germany, to stop being complacent, to wake up to the fact that there aren't bigger threats today than there were decades ago. But we do need you to take a strong stance against these certain ones to make sure that this European utopia will spread. Well, as Richard said in his article, what if this view of history is horribly, horribly wrong? What if you take away the American security umbrella and everything reverts back to what we saw in the 1940s, in 1914, in the late 1800s, in the early 1800s. This has been routine. This has been prophesied. This has happened over and over again. As I've said, even with the Napoleon reading, it's astounding how many people want to just kind of romanticize this war machine that Napoleon led. Hundreds and thousands of deaths, casualties, sickness, disease associated with those many wars of conquest there in the early 1800s. People want to go back and revise this history and say, well, hey, actually, Europe has generated, it's reached the pinnacle of human well-being, said Barack Obama. He went on to say in that town hall, clip two.
Collectively in Europe right now, on average, you probably see the highest standards of living of any group of people in the history of the planet. Wealthier, healthier, better educated.
Now, who's driven the economy of over the past 100 years? What single nation is to be credited most for raising the standard of living for the entirety of the world? And why is it if this same former president was in Chicago or St. Louis, going back to, again, the cities of the United States, why is it when he's over there in his own home country, he would go on and on about how many people are suffering? How many people are in poverty? How many people are this or that? Then he goes to Europe and says, it's wonderful. This is a miracle, really. The pinnacle of human well-being and achievement. And listen to any of them. There's 18 candidates now. Listen to them talk about the United States. Listen to them talk about America. Will they ever say in the next 2 years, it's going to be a constant campaign mode for them, will they ever say anything like this collectively, you're seeing the highest standards of living of any group of people in the history of the planet, wealthier, healthier, and better educated. Barack Obama needs to get on a plane and go to Europe before he can say something like that. He said one last thing at that town hall, or at least one that we have here, clip three.
The continent has largely been at peace for 70 years. You have unprecedented information at your fingertips. You can travel freely across borders that once were closed. Our societies have made great strides to extend opportunity and educate our children and care for the sick and to pursue equality for people no matter what you look like or how you worship or who you love. So you would think that everybody'd feel pretty good right now. And yet, what we also know is that powerful forces are threatening to reverse many of these trends.
And of course, those forces are their political enemies. All these good things going on. But we just have to take down people like Donald Trump, and this utopia can continue. That's his worldview. It's very strange hearing that from an American on European soil. But going back to this meeting between Merkel and Obama, Legal Insurrection points out, it compiles a lot of the headlines. It's really a big story that I know the American media will be quite bored with today. But at Legal Insurrection, it says German Chancellor Angela Merkel welcomed former U.S. President Obama to Berlin on Saturday. The meeting was closed to the press. Closed to the press. For this president that once billed himself as the most transparent president in the history of the United States. It says the German government spokesman Stefan Siebert, declined comment on the content of the talks. He wouldn't even comment. It's private. It's private. You don't need to know. Nobody needs to know. It says the duo did not stop for photos or take questions from journalists, stressing that the meeting was not a political event. This is a private meeting. You keep out of it. It says, despite official denials in Berlin, the German media dubbed it a political meeting with the duo discussing the widening rift between Merkel-led government and President Donald Trump's administration. So a little bit leaked out. We know the discussion revolved around Donald Trump and the rift between Germany and the United States. And here comes Barack Obama to try to back the United States, to try to support the United States, to try to build up the United States and its economy, or to make an argument for the United States regarding trade or NATO. The United States pays 70% of the cost for NATO. Nearly three quarters of it is funded by the United States. It says here, our president, that was the headline at Der Tagesspiegel, our president, they don't see Trump as their president or the U.S. president they're working with. They look at Barack Obama as our president. We've got to wait this out. Hopefully he'll be gone in 2 years and we'll get somebody else in there who's just like Barack Obama. Obama evokes nostalgia in Germany. That's the New York Times quote or headline that I quoted earlier. The UK's Daily Mail, life is so much harder with the new guy. That was the headline here in the UK. Talks about the two, Obama and Merkel, they're spotted in a warm embrace, meeting at the Chancellery. The German paper, Die Welt, it said this, Chancellor Angela Merkel met with the former U.S. President Barack Obama for an hour and a half long exchange of views. The main topic is considered to be the strained transatlantic relations. These ties have significantly deteriorated since President Obama's Republican successor, Donald Trump, took office. A big contentious issue is the protectionist economic policies pursued by the Americans. And the press, remember when he was in the private room with Vladimir Putin and they just went crazy. They had to find out. They wanted to get the translator so that they could find out what was said in there. But this meeting, it's private. It's just private. It says on the eve of the meeting, Obama received applause from more than 14,000 people at the World Leadership Summit in Cologne. Among other things, the Democratic politician spoke of confident and cautious optimism that the United States will soon take the lead in climate protection. Here's another bit. This is from the German newspaper, the Rheinpost. It said, this is a political signal, especially at a time when Donald Trump, Obama's successor as the U.S. president, never misses an opportunity to criticize Merkel and the Germans. Just recently, he used the ceremonies to mark the NATO anniversary in Washington to slam the ally, Germany. Right, it's Donald Trump who's doing all of the criticizing. No criticism from Barack Obama, certainly none from Merkel. Certainly no criticism coming from NATO. It's all Donald Trump, you see. This is so overwhelmingly lopsided. And then you've got to kind of weed through everything to find a few German publications that had to be translated into English just to get a little bit of what happened there. And of course, on the news cycle today, you won't hear one thing about this. Or if you do, it'll be about how popular the former president still is in Germany. Legal Insurrection says here, the newspaper was referring to President Trump's demand that all NATO allies should meet their defense spending targets. As Legal Insurrection reported recently, well, it gives the figures, 70% the U.S. is funding. Hillary Clinton's unexpected defeat is widely regarded as the reason why Merkel sought a fourth term back in 2017. As Obama staffer Ben Rhodes admitted in the 2017 memoir, the German leader told Obama that she felt more obliged to run for another term because of Mr. Trump's election to defend the liberal international order. Today, this globalist order is on shaky ground. On the other side of the Atlantic, Obama's highly publicized visit comes in the backdrop. It says it comes in the backdrop if the upcoming European Union election set for late May. Opinion polls project, well, it goes on to some of the speculation over the voting in Germany and beyond. But this is really astounding, isn't it? The resistance that the current U.S. president is facing from every direction, domestically, internationally, from politicians out of office, private citizens, you name it. Every single direction. Where is this leading? This push, this love affair with Germany. Germany, you take the lead. You solve the problems. You're the answer. And here they are. They're being urged on by all of Donald Trump's political enemies back home in America. And the press hardly bats an eye. I thought this one final statement that we have here, this says a lot, too, about this man's worldview, about his thinking. Listen to what he says about young people in this last clip from that town hall, clip 4.
When we hear that young people aren't voting or participating, we say to them, you would not let your grandfather or grandmother decide what clothes you wear or what music you listen to. So why would you let them decide the world you're going to live in and the politics that you're going to be subjected to?
Isn't that a nice sentiment? Their message for young people? You won't listen to your grandparents. You won't let your grandparents tell you what to do. So why should you let them shape your worldview? Why don't you rise up? Why don't you rise up and take this world in a new direction? And many young people they're hearing that battle cry and they're responding. But think of it, here, and to say grandparents, these are some of the ones that were actually there fighting the forces of tyranny, spearheaded by Germany. That's the truth. That's the truth of the 20th century. And we can thank our grandparents that we have the freedoms and the prosperity and the wealth that we have today. How much more money do you suppose is in the pocket of an average teenager today as compared to 1935 or even 1950 or 1955? To think of the sacrifices, to think of the hardship, to think of how high our standard of living is today. He said it. He went to Europe and he talked about this utopian state of well-being. He acknowledges the prosperity, the standard of living. And then he comes along and says, hey, don't listen to your grandparents. You wouldn't let them tell you what clothes to wear or what music to listen to. Don't let them tell you what kind of world this should be. Rebel! Go ahead, walk out of class. Do it for climate change. And they're doing it, so many of them. If you wonder where this is leading, just read through Isaiah 3. Well, read through Isaiah 1 to get the context. Read through the first few chapters of Isaiah, and you'll understand. When we come back, we'll go back even earlier to the very first chapter in the book of Genesis. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM. And this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
On Friday's show, I mentioned the Spectator piece by Richard Holloway. He's an Episcopalian priest from Scotland. He's writing this Spectator piece, as a review to a book about the Bible, A History of the Bible, I think is the name of it. But in the course of this article, he talks about people who take sections of the Bible literally. It says here, there are conservative Christians who cleave to belief in a six-day creation because they're convinced that the Bible can never be wrong about anything, thus placing themselves on an unnecessary collision course with modern science, to the delight of evangelical atheists who quote them as proof of the infantilizing nature of all religious belief. So on Friday's show, we went back to the beginning, Genesis 1, verses 1 through 2, and we pointed out something that they don't see on either side of the debate. They don't see it. The evangelical atheists and the evangelical Christians. There's four key themes in the Genesis 1 account. You've got the original creation. We touched on that Friday. Then you've got the angelic rebellion and destruction. We also touched on that Friday. And then the renewal of the original creation. We didn't have time really to get into much of that, but that's what most of the chapter is devoted to. Genesis 1, the renewal. And all of that then led up to the fourth key theme, and that would be the special creation of man. And so it says in Genesis 1 and verse 1, just to repeat a little bit of what we went into Friday, in the beginning, or in a beginning, God created the heavens, plural, and the earth. In a beginning. Going back millions and millions of years, perhaps, God created the universe and the earth. But what most people don't realize is that there's a time lapse between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And last week I took you through that verse, Isaiah 45 and verse 18, which says that God created the universe and the earth. Not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. He formed the earth, it says there, so that it would be inhabited. He created it not in vain. And if you look at the Hebrew word for vain in that verse from Isaiah 45:18, it means waste and empty. So God didn't, and this makes common sense. If you understand and know anything about God, he's not going to create something to just sit there in a state of wasteness and decay. So Genesis 1 and verse 1 says, in the beginning, or in a beginning, God created the heaven, or heavens, it should read, and the earth. And then in verse 2 it says, and the earth was, it was without form and void. Tohu and bohu, that word form, it's the same Hebrew word as the one translated in vain over in Isaiah 45. So in the one hand, you've got a verse that says he didn't create it in a state of tohu and bohu. But here in verse 2 of Genesis 1, it says the earth was without form and void. In other words, it was in tohu and bohu. What happened? Well, if you look at that word was, it means became. It's the same word used in Genesis 19 and verse 26, where it says Lot's wife became a pillar of salt. She was a human being, but then she became a pillar of salt. So God didn't create it in a state of tohu and bohu. Those are the Hebrew words. But it says here in verse 2 that the earth became that way. Why? What happened? In the incredible human potential, it says God is creator. God is also ruler over his creation. He preserves what he creates by his government. What God creates, he has created for a purpose. Again, you see that in Isaiah 45:18. He creates it for a purpose, to be used, preserved, and maintained. And this use is regulated by God's government. It says, when the angels rebelled against God's government, the preservation of the physical earth and all its original beauty and glory ceased, and physical destruction to the surface of the earth resulted. It says, God is creator, preserver, and ruler. Satan is destroyer. Now, you can read more about Lucifer's rebellion, about Lucifer's lawlessness in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. We don't have time to go through all these passages. But suffice it to say, he was put on this earth, Lucifer was. He was trained at the throne of God, and those two chapters I just gave to you, they bring this out. But then he was stationed to this earth. He was assigned jurisdiction over this earth where he would administer God's government and where he would continue God's creative handiwork, beautifying and maintaining the surface of this earth. But he didn't do that. Instead, he rebelled against God, and he brought darkness and ugliness, chaos, waste, emptiness. He brought all of that to this earth. So verse 2 again, it says, and the earth was without form and void. It became tohu and dohu, it says, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And so here was the earth just covered in darkness. Covered in darkness. And it says God's Spirit, the Spirit of God, moved upon the face of the waters. So God set out to recreate and beautify the surface of the earth again, to prepare it for human life, to prepare it for material life. Psalm 104 and verse 30. It says, you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. How come there aren't more theologians that understand these verses? What does it mean to renew something? It means it was there. It was there. There was an original creation, but it needed to be renewed. And what you read about in most of Genesis 1 is the renewal, preparing the surface of the earth for man's existence. You send forth your spirit, just like we read in verse 2, and the Spirit of God moves upon the face of the waters. Have you ever noticed that? God's Spirit moved on the surface of this earth. And it says the same in Psalm 104:30. You send forth your spirit, and you renew the face of the earth. The earth wasn't made 6,000 years ago. We can agree with the evangelical atheists on that. But it was renewed. It was renewed. And then you start studying into the biblical genealogies. And again, it takes you back to about 6,000 years or so. And if scholars are honest, really, the archaeological evidence, it shows the same thing. Civilizations that have turned up. It goes back 4,000, 5,000 years, and then it starts going dry. And people can invent geological ages all that they want. And they can talk about the caveman for 10,000, 10 million years ago, all that they want. But we're dealing with the evidence that we've seen, even from science and archaeology, and most especially here from the biblical account. God created the earth and the universe millions of years ago, perhaps. But around 6,000 years ago, the surface needed to be renewed in order for it to sustain human life. So you read about that here in Genesis 1, and then you look out into space, into the universe, and we're able to see further and further because of telescopes and such. What do you see out there? What do you see when there's a landing on the moon? Or when there's some kind of scientific gadget that lands on Mars? What do we see? We certainly don't see the life-sustaining surface that you see on Earth. And all of that just happens to be described in Genesis 1, verse 3. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from darkness. Here is God's spirit, God's power in action. God spoke, and it was done. The correspondence course, it says, God is the one who said, "Let there be light," and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, performed the command. Moving upon the face of the waters, performed the command, it says, and there was light instantly. The Holy Spirit is a miracle-working power. It overcomes obstacles. And this is the part, of course, that the scientific community, the godless scientific community, rejects. Revelation, miracles, they don't accept it. But here is God, if we just read the account, if we understand the time lapse, here is God preparing the earth for mankind. This is a turning point, verse 3. This is God making the environment capable of supporting human life. And so he starts by clearing away a lot of the smoke and the gas, everything that made this planet dark, just covered in darkness. And God said, "The light. It's good." And there's a stark division now between light and darkness. And of course, when you understand this too on the spiritual level, it really does give a lot of depth to this passage, even this first chapter of the Bible. Jesus Christ, of course, he came to start a new world, a new civilization. And it says in John 3 that he was a light coming into this world. But men wouldn't accept him because they love darkness. Spiritually speaking, this world is still covered in darkness. But that will soon change, and it's going to take some miracles from God. It's going to take God's intervention on the affairs of mankind. But going back to this recreation, notice verse 5, it says, "And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day." So this is how God defines or marks time. It starts with the nighttime portion, sunset, and it ends with the day portion. Verse 6, "And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." God forms this layer of fresh air, this heavenly sky, the earth's atmosphere, And we need that in order to breathe, to live. This is, again, God preparing the surface for us. Verse 7, and God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. Now, I won't bog down too much into the Hebrew words here, but the word for made, it comes from the Greek word, or rather the Hebrew word, asa, A-S-A-H, as opposed to the word for created in verse 1, the original creation. That's the Hebrew word bara. They're two different words, and I've made the distinction between verse 1, the creation that happened there potentially millions of years ago, or possibly millions of years ago, and the time lapse, and then what happened with Tohu and Bohu, and then the recreation. But what's happening here in verse 7, that Hebrew word asa, it means to work upon anything, to make or produce as by labor, to manufacture or fabricate, to alter, or to fashion from existing materials. So there was a lot of work that God was putting in, but the point being, it wasn't a new creation. It wasn't a brand new creation with everything starting just 6,000 years ago. This was God renewing the face of the earth, making or fashioning a firmament. Verse 9 says, and God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And so God evidently did some rearranging, raising some areas, lowering others, forming the continents, setting certain limits here or there. It's pretty amazing. Down in verse 14 it says, and God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And so here's the astronomical laws that we would need to mark time: days, weeks, months, years, even the seven-day week. You see that runs right through this chapter from beginning to end. And men have tried to devise, different ways in which to mark time. But we're 6,000 years on, and we still have the seven-day week. That in itself, just like so much else in the first chapters of Genesis, it just confirms God's existence, God's involvement in this creation. The Sabbath, that was in the first part of chapter 2 of Genesis. God obviously created marriage and family. That's talked about in chapter 2 as well, Genesis 2. He made them male and female. That's chapter 1. It's all there, the foundation. It's all there in the book of beginnings. Verse 20 says, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has life, and the fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And so the sky and the sea, they're just filled with life, teeming with physical beings, sea life, birds of the sky, and so on. And then verse 24, God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle and the creeping thing and the beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind. We see that still to this day. And cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, here's verse 26, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. What a distinction here between man and beast. In the incredible human potential, it says, here is an awesome truth. Look now at the situation as God must have seen and considered it. God has given us minds like the mind of God, only inferior and limited. God made us in his image, after his likeness, form and shape, only composed of matter instead of spirit. But God says to us, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. We can learn to think his thoughts after him. We have his spirit. Or it says, if we have it, we can learn to think to some degree, even as God thinks. What an incredible human potential. And then when you think about that vision, that plan, that hope, as it extends even beyond the surface of this earth, on out into the universe. Well, you'll have to read the rest of the incredible human potential for that. Just to sum up here, though, verse 31, and God saw everything that he made, including man and woman, everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. And from there, God went and rested on the seventh day. There's another subject we'll have to get into at some time, the seventh day Sabbath, established there at the recreation. That's all, though, that we have time for on today's show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.